Here we go. This meeting of the House Transportation Committee will now come to order. It is 1:13 p.m. on Thursday, April 3rd, 2025, in Capitol Room 124. Members present are Representative McCabe, Representative Tilton, Representative Stutes, Representative Mina, Representative Moore, Co-Chair Carrick, and myself, Co-Chair Eichheid. That the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business. And my apologies for being slightly late. We're having some technology issues. Please take this time to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. Thank you. Before we begin, I would like to thank Suniva St. Clair from House Records, as well as Susan Quigley from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee today. Our committee aides are Meredith Trainer and staffer Griffin Sokeo. Thank you for your help. Without you, this work is not possible. On today's agenda is a presentation from Kim Solian, Executive Director of the Mat-Su Valley Planning for Transportation, and she's going to be talking on the boundary development process and formation of the Mat-Su Valley Metropolitan Planning Organization. We're going to be using some acronyms today, so MPO stands for Metropolitan Planning Organization, and then MVP, Mat-Su Valley Planning. Joining Ms. Solian to share testimony with the committee will be Brian Winnestaffer, Mat-Su Valley Planning Policy Board Member, and Donna Gardino of Gardino Consulting. She's a Principal Planner and former MPO Director. Following the presentation from Ms. Solian and comments from Mr. Winnestaffer and Ms. Gardino, we'll hear brief testimony on the MP Metropolitan Planning Area Boundaries from Catherine Keith, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. And we'll wrap up our presentation testimony today with testimony by Fairbanks Area Surface Transportation Planning Policy Board members, Greer Hopkins, Mayor of the Fairbanks North Star Borough, and Scott Crass, Assembly Member from the Fairbanks North Star Borough. Joining Mr. Hopkins and Mr. Crass is Fairbanks Area Surface Transportation Planning Executive Director, Jackson Fox. I'm very proud how I got through all that. I just want to do a sound check. Ms. Solian, can you hear us? Ms. Solian, can you hear us? Because say something, we're not hearing you. Okay, I think we're going to take a brief at ease while we fix a technology issue. back at on the record at 1:18 p.m. We're having some technology issues. Ms. Solian, can you hear us?
I didn't get that. Could you try again?
Yes, I can.
My apologies. Okay, thank you, Ms. Solian, for joining us online remotely. Please put yourself on your record and begin your presentation.
Excellent. Thank you, Representative Eichscheid. My name is Kim Solian, and I am here today with Brian Windstaffer, a member of MVP's Policy Board, and Donna Gardino, a consultant for MVP. I am the newly appointed executive director for MVP, Mattsu Valley Planning for Transportation, the newest MPO in Alaska. And I have a presentation for you here today, though, and I just want to make sure you can see my slides because I can't see what you're seeing.
Yes, we can see your slides.
Okay. So for my presentation, I may ask Brian Windstaffer and Donna Gardino to chime in as I'm going through the presentation. So I just wanted to make you all aware of that.
Yeah, thank you.
Ms.
Solian, just a note for you and your co-presenters. Whenever a new person starts talking, you change the speaker. Just they should identify themselves for the record so that people can follow along. So thank you.
Excellent. So we can move on to the next slide. So for today, based on the invitation to speak to you all, thank you very much for the invite. Excuse me, I also have had the longest cold in my life for the past 6 weeks since I'm still coughing, so I apologize for that. I'm gonna go over a little bit about our MPO organizational development and where we've been for the last 4 years and where we're headed in the future with some of our organizational development tasks. But then I'm also going to talk about our boundary development process and the steps we went through to develop our metropolitan planning area boundary. And then I'm going to highlight some of our involvement with the STIP development process and those challenges. Next slide. So in anticipation of the certification of the 2020 census, the state of Alaska, DOT, anticipated that the Mattsu Borough would receive an urban area designation and would need to form a metropolitan planning organization for our region. And so the Mattsu Borough received a grant in 2019 to support the pre-development of our MPO. And so early on in 2020, we formed a pre-technical committee and started meeting about that included members of the Mattsu Borough, Planning and Public Works, the City of Palmer, the City of Wasilla, our two tribal governments, Kinnick Tribe and Chickaloon Native Village, transit advocates, bike and pedestrian advocates, the railroad, and a few other interested parties to start talking about the need for us to develop an MPO. What is an MPO? What is the role of an MPO? And we started having regular meetings in September 2022. And we formed a pre-policy board the next year because we knew that to form our organization, we would need to have the member organizations that would be responsible, that would make up the future policy board, make some decisions about how we are going to organize as an MPO, what our organizational structure would be, who would make up the committees, what our processes would be. And so we did that. So our pre-policy board was a bit broader than our eventual policy board, and I'll talk with you about that in a future slide. So we also decided that our MPO needed to be a nonprofit organization. At the time when we were talking about our formation, the Mattsu Borough and the cities expressed that they did not have the capacity or for the borough the legal authority to house our MPO within their organization, and so that we needed to be an independent organization and have nonprofit status like Fast Planning does in Fairbanks. We also, you know, then received a $1 million grant from the state legislature because there are membership fees and match requirements associated with the funding that we receive that's passed through that needed to be supported in the pre-phase, but then also Alaska DOT didn't have a mechanism to pay its membership fees or its dues, and so that grant was granted to us. The Mat-Su Borough holds that grant on our behalf, and we're in the process right now of actually finalizing a grant agreement because some of those funds will come directly to MVP, so that we'll use that as capital flow because all of our grant funds are reimbursable. We approved our first UPWP, which is our Unified Planning Work Program. So it's like the work plan for the staff of the MPO. We finalized the work plan for our Metropolitan Transportation Plan, which is our largest planning project that we'll do as an MPO every 4 years to plan where the infrastructure needs to go within the planning area. We also had our boundary approved, our policy board approved in September of 23. And then we had our operating agreement signed in December of 2023. And that was kind of a race from when the census was certified. We had 1 year to get all that package put together and signed. And I think the deadline was December 29th. Next slide. So we do have a 7-member policy board. Like I said earlier, our pre-policy board was a bit larger and had a more diverse group. We had nonprofits and other advocates that were serving on the pre-policy board to help us with our original formation documents. But it was determined by the pre-policy board that our policy board should be a representation of only local governments. And then our technical committee is a much larger body that has nonprofit members and community members in addition to the cities and the tribes, public works and planning staff. So we have the mayor of Wasilla. She's the chair of the policy board, Mayor Ledford. The vice chair is the mayor of Palmer, Mayor Carrington. Bob Charles is the roads director for Kinnick Tribe. He's our secretary. Sean Holland, the central region director for DOT, is our treasurer. Brian Winstaffer, who's on the call with us today, is on the board. He's the transportation director for Chickaloon Native Village. And then the borough advocated to have 2 seats on the policy board because their position was that the vast majority of road miles within our metropolitan planning area are borough, that they felt like they wanted to have an extra vote when it came to, you know, making funding decisions about projects because they had a lot more infrastructure to manage and support. So Mayor DeVries and Mike Brown, the manager, is also on the policy board. Next slide. Oh, excuse me. So this is a kind of a transition of where we are today. As I mentioned before, our operating agreement has been signed. Our boundary was finalized. That whole package was complete in December of 2023. Because we decided that we were going to be a nonprofit organization, we needed to file our 501c3 paperwork and get our EIN number and our articles of incorporation with the state of Alaska to be recognized as a nonprofit corporation. And last October, we did receive the letter from the IRS and the certification from the state recognizing us as a nonprofit. As a nonprofit, we needed to draft all of our fiscal and personnel and organizational policies. Those have all been completed and adopted. I was hired in, now I'm forgetting when, March, I think, to be the executive director of MVP. We received our membership dues from all of our partners. And we opened a bank account, and I'm about ready to hire some additional staff to help us with some of our planning projects. And on tomorrow, actually, we kick off our Metropolitan Transportation Plan project with a consulting team. So that's very exciting. It feels like it's been a long road to get here for the past four and a half years or so, but we've made a lot of progress, and it's been really great to see, I think, the relationships strengthen between the cities, the borough, the tribes, and the DOT planning staff that we work with on a regular basis.
Thank you, Ms. Olean. Just a brief pause. We have some questions. I have two, but Representative Tilton has the first one.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and through the Chair. I may be a little behind in Metropolitan whatever the whole name is, operating programs. But my question was, you talked about a seven-member policy board, which you named the members of the policy, people on the policy board, but then you said that there was going to be a technical committee. And what is that technical committee made up of? Are those members of the public, or is that staff members who are preparing the plan? And just trying to understand that a little better.
Excellent. Through the chair to Representative Tilton. That is an excellent question. Who is our technical committee? And I wish I had put a slide in to show that representation. So the organization is structured to have two bodies that oversee the work of the staff in terms of putting together our long-range plans for where, you know, what the future infrastructure needs are and where things will go. So our technical committee is kind of like the workhorse that supports staff, but it's made up by, we have a 16-member technical committee. We have the Public Works Director and the Planning Director from the Mat-Su Borough, Public Works Director from the City of Palmer, Public Works Director from the City of Wasilla, both of the transportation directors from Kinnick Tribe and Chickaloon Native Village. We have representation from the railroad. We have a community representative of the Mat-Su Borough RSA board. We have a community member who represents the trucking industry. We have a transit, the director of Valley Transit serves on the board. And then we also have someone who represents DEC and oversees kind of future air quality issue potential that the Mat-Su might have. And then we have two representatives from DOT, the planning chief for Central Region, and the I'm forgetting Clint Adler's title, but he's the engineer in the Mat-Su office that oversees that team. And then we also have a representative from State Parks, actually, that holds the seat for park and pedestrian and trail advocates, so non-motorized advocates. So it's a diverse group, but everyone has an interest in one mode of transportation, and they also meet monthly. So every time staff work on a plan or a project, we bring it through our technical committee, they review it, they have questions, they have edits, and then if they think the document is solid and ready to move forward, then they would formally make a recommendation that the policy board approve, and then we bring that piece of information, that plan, that project to the policy board for final approval. Does that answer your question, Representative?
Follow up if possible.
Yeah, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Through the chair, it sounds like there's a few members that maybe aren't governmental, but for the most part, this is all a governmental agency, so to speak, or committee. Where does the public fit into this whole process?
Excellent question. Through the chair to Representative Tilden. That is another excellent question. So all of our meetings are open to the public. They are advertised in the Frontiersman and on our website. Soon we'll have a social media presence and we'll be advocating and advertising our meetings to the public, but we're not quite there yet in terms of our organizational development. So yes, most of the members except for three on our technical committee represent a government entity, and then we have those three at-large seats to represent transit, trucking, and bike and pedestrian advocates. We have an application process that we advertised for folks interested in serving in that role, and had folks apply for the position, and then the policy board actually recommended or approved those applicants to serve. So at every single one of our technical committee meetings and our policy board meetings, we have an open, we call it voices of the visitors or persons to be heard, where members of the public can attend our meeting. They're hybrid, in person and online. Members of the public can attend the meeting and have time on our agenda to speak. And then when we have action items on our agenda, there's always time made available for members of the public to weigh in on any of those action items. When we dig into developing our Metropolitan Transportation Plan, you'll probably see a lot more MVP presence in the community because we will be meeting with community councils and RSA districts and other targeted members of the public, maybe public transit riders or bike commuters. So we'll be reaching out in a larger way beyond our monthly meetings to members of the public to get feedback. The other thing is when we do a plan or a project, we also have a public comment period that's advertised. So with our public participation plan, that's one of the key plans that's required in federal regulation that we develop that outlines how we're going to communicate with the public, how we're going to invite the public to be involved. That plan was advertised for a 45-day public comment window, with a 45-day public comment window, and we sent that to all the community councils. It was advertised in the paper. It was advertised on our website to solicit feedback on that plan. And then when we get the comments, we incorporate the comments and then produce a final document for review. So really the public is at the center of all the work that we will do. The MVP is early in its evolution. We haven't done some of our major plans yet, but very soon.
Thank you. Can I have one quick
Yes.
follow-up? And I know I'm taking a lot of time here and there's lots of slides. So one quick follow-up, just wondering about on the actual committee itself, the technical committee or your policy committee, the representation just from the private sector in maybe like a large private sector land developer or something like that. I feel like that might be a piece that's missing there. So you don't have to comment. That's just more of a comment of my own.
Thank you. And then Ms. Soli and I had two questions. And by the way, excellent questions from Representative Tilton. The first question is, you described quite a process, like in the next slide, with the arrows. What guides this process? What is the authority that dictates this long process to, and just briefly, I mean, it's a federal government, I believe. Is that correct?
To Representative Eichheit, your question might be in two parts. The development of a metropolitan planning organization is set out in federal regulation Title 23, that talks about the need to form a metropolitan planning organization to support the planning of where infrastructure needs to go to allow for federal funds to flow into an area. And so Title 23 is very spelled out in terms of all the steps and all the things that an MPO needs to do to be in good standing related to having a UPWP and a Metropolitan Transportation Plan and a TIP, which is the short-term funding plan of projects that are in the long-range transportation plan, our public participation plan, and our Title 6 plan. And so those things are spelled out. But in terms of us, MVP, becoming a nonprofit organization, all those other organizational development steps, like we had to put that work plan together and flow through the process. Fortunately, FAST Planning is a nonprofit organization and they have been incredible mentors to us because they, I think it was 5 years ago, went through the transition from a hosted MPO with the Fairbanks North Star Borough to a nonprofit organization and being independent.
Yeah, thank you. And just, real short answer on this. Most folks understand transportation, they think of DOT. And maybe some people might say, yeah, there's a federal component to that. But most of us think of DOT or our local road service entities. So what is essentially, in a concise way, what is the function of this MPO? Why do we have it? Obviously it's in federal regulation, but what's the purpose of it, just so the public can understand why it even exists? What was the logic behind it?
To the chair, Representative Eichheit, great question. So I may get my dates wrong, but I believe back in 1954, when President Eisenhower was pushing forward the idea of a national interstate system and the need for a federal highway system to go through all the major cities across the U.S. Lots of grant funds were given to state DOTs to build their portion of the interstate system. Well, within a matter of years, nearly every major city across the country was having an interstate segment built through their state. And the state DOTs, not in all cases, but in many cases, didn't communicate with the local community about the section of highway going through their town. And many communities were devastated or separated or displaced because the highway was going through a neighborhood and that local city or that local borough didn't actually have a say in whether or not they agreed with the placement of that section of highway. So when President Kennedy came into office, there had been a number of states or cities and counties and boroughs that had sued the state DOTs to stop construction on highway projects and requesting a different process. And so President Kennedy changed the, added a portion to the highway bill that required the continuous, cooperative, and comprehensive 3C planning process to take place within communities if they were going to receive federal funding. So that legislation eventually turned into the requirement to have MPOs. So every community across the country, if you reach a threshold of 50,000 people or more in a contiguous area, it triggers the need to form an MPO, to engage with the state DOT, to have a 3C process, to make sure those federal funds that are coming into that region are being used in a way that the communities actually want and not just what a larger government entity wants. And so it's really about thinking about the Metropolitan Transportation Plan and this long-range 20-year plan of our communities growing. We have the cities, the tribes, the borough, and the state all at the table deciding where is the most need, where are their safety issues, where are their congestion issues, where are their connectivity issues, where is there a need for transit infrastructure, or bike and pedestrian infrastructure, and together the policy board of the MPO are making that determination together and putting it in the plan, and that's what allows the federal funding to come into the region. So really the reason for MPO being is to ensure that no one entity is out doing whatever they want in isolation and not working together with the local and regional governments to plan for infrastructure.
Thank you. That was a super thorough answer. What I gathered is just to bring a local voice into transportation planning infrastructure. So thank you for that. Please continue. One more question from Representative Tilton.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. This is my last question on this slide, obviously. That was a great explanation, but I think that I might have heard you say that when they reach a 50,000 people plus that they're required to have the MPO. Is that correct? Did I hear that correctly? It's a requirement or is it an option?
Through the chair to Representative Tilden, it is a requirement that if you want to receive federal funding, forming an MP, like for in that region, forming a metropolitan planning organization is a requirement. Once the census designates your community as having an urban area, which means that there are 50,000 people or more within a contiguous area, the requirement is that a metropolitan planning organization is formed to be responsible for the planning within that region for transportation infrastructure to receive those to receive federal funds.
Thank you.
Okay, go ahead, please.
Okay, slide number 6. So I'm going to transition my presentation to how MVP approached the development of our metropolitan planning area boundary, and so I'm also going to. If Brian and Donna, I'll pause a little bit sometimes. If you want to add to the discussion as I'm going through these slides, please feel free to chime in. So the map that you're looking at right now is MVP's metropolitan planning area boundary. So I'll come back to this visual later. But essentially, when the census designates an area as having an urban area, there is a requirement that the MPO form its own planning area boundary that has a 20-year horizon outlook, looking at where do we think the population is going to grow over the next 20 years, so that when we're working on our long-range plan, our metropolitan transportation plan, we're planning for that future growth and ensuring that the infrastructure that we're developing is going to meet the community need. So in terms of how do we come up with this boundary and figure out how do we know where the population is going to grow and where they're going to go? We put together a boundary development strategy that was approved by the policy board in October of 21. And I believe I sent all of these documents ahead to Meredith if you wanted to review them in the future, and I can resend them if you didn't get them. So we had an approved boundary development strategy that looked at population forecasts, current issues, development trends, and helped guide how we would come up with this future boundary. We also had a population forecast memo that was developed to figure out who's projecting population growth and what number should we use to figure out how our boundary should, how large it should be. We also had a final report on the boundary and then the final map. We'll just go to the next slide. So in December, we got notification December 29th, 2022, that the U.S. Census did identify a portion of the Mat-Su Borough Greater Core Area as a qualifying urban area with a population of 50,000, over 50,000 people. The title in the Census Federal Register is that the Wasilla, Kinnick, Fairview, North Lakes urban area. And it was, all of us thought, was curious that Palmer wasn't in there, and we didn't know what that would mean. We didn't receive the map until the following month, so we didn't know what the urban area looked like, but we had a guess. So the borough was designated as having an urban cluster, which is not quite 50,000 people in the 2010 census, so we had a good guess. Next slide, please. So this is the map from the U.S. Census that we received, and so it highlighted, yes, it did include the city of Palmer and Wasilla and that greater North Lakes area and down Kinnick Goose Bay Road. It really wasn't a surprise because that is the most densely developed area of the borough when we think about population density. So determining that density, you know, one of the core requirements is that it's 1,000 people per square mile or 400 dwelling units or so per square mile in a contiguous area over 50,000 people. And that's the determination. Next slide. So once a urban area is designated, you have 1 year to form an MPO to continue to receive federal funding and to carry out that cooperative, continuing, and comprehensive process that I talked about earlier, the 3C process. And so with forming the MPO, you need to establish an operating agreement that outlines who's part of the MPO, what government entities are involved. I will just say for small MPOs, it's not spelled out in federal regulation how big or small the board can be. It needs to be the largest city, the largest government that represents the largest amount of population, and the DOT. MVP decided to, we offered all the cities within our boundary, in the urbanized area, plus the tribes and the borough, a seat on the policy board. But it could have been smaller. Next slide.
Just a moment, Representative Tilton.
I am very curious today. Thank you, Mr. Kutcher, and through the chair. Not that anyone would want to, but could an area that was identified via the census say that they don't want to be a part of this, like a far-end area of Kinnick, KGB, or or, you know, is like it doesn't look like it's contiguous in the map, or Palmer isn't even connecting to Wasilla. So my question is, could an area by through a via community council or some other means say, well, we didn't ask to be part of this and we don't want to be part of this?
Through the chair to Representative Tilden, that's a great question. Donna's turned on her camera. Do you want to help answer that question, or do you want me to start? Okay. So I'll use the city of Palmer as an example, because when we were forming our policy board, the city was represented on the pre-policy board, but once it came to finalizing the operating agreement and formally being a member of the policy board, there definitely was question from the Palmer City Council as to whether or not they wanted to be part of the MPO. And ultimately, they decided that they did want to be a part, because if they the MPO would still be planning for projects within their area, but they wouldn't have a seat at the table to say whether or not a project was a priority for them or not, or potentially wouldn't have access to the funds that, and potentially wouldn't have access to the funding that it will be coming through our MPO to support a project that they may have wanted. So ultimately, they decided being part of the MPO and having a seat at the table to decide how federal funds are being used within our planning area was better for them than staying outside the planning area. In terms of a community council opting in or opting out, like they're bodies that represent a population that we communicate with, but they aren't. They weren't part of deciding our planning area boundary to be in or out. That's all based on population and population density. So unless, Donna, you want to add anything to what I've shared, I think that's all I'll share about opting in or opting out.
Yeah, thank you. I'll probably talk to you a little bit more later offline. Thank you.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So, Ms. Saleen, I think I just heard you say if the entire city of Palmer had an election and a referendum and said, we don't want to be a part of an MPO, that you could still, as an MPO, plan Palmer's roads and the use of federal funds in Palmer? And they just wouldn't have any representation?
Through the chair to Representative McCabe, I may have misspoke on that. So our planning area boundary, the requirement is that all of the urban area, so that map on page 8, the urban area bound, our planning area boundary has to encompass all of the urban area boundary. And so Palmer is included in our metropolitan planning area, because that's the federal requirement. But if they chose not to be part of the policy board, what I was trying to say is that they wouldn't have a voice at the table then related to how federal funds could be used locally. So we might identify as a planning organization that there needs to be a transit stop in Palmer to support public transit or the expansion of services throughout the city, but they wouldn't be voting to have that transit stop within our Metropolitan Transportation Plan or in our TIP. So I think that's what I was trying to say, that they wouldn't have a voice on whether or not that was a priority project for them, though they could participate in public involvement. Donna?
Yes. So could I get a brief follow-up, Ms. Saleen? So I think what you, through the chair, what you just said to me is exactly the reason MPOs were established in the first place, so that municipalities or metropolitan areas could have a say. But what if they don't want a say? What if they don't want that transportation stop or that bus stop or the trails that that you're planned? What if they don't want it? I mean, that's the whole reason the MPOs were set up in the first place, is to prevent big government overreach from driving over the top of little cities that didn't want it. So I think I just heard you say that Palmer, or, and I'm just using Palmer as an example, would be sort of forced to accept the MPO's plans, if you will.
If I may, through the chair to Representative McCabe. So
I need to do my laundry.
Me too.
there's a little bleed through there, but go ahead, Ms. Soline, and certainly bring in Ms. Gardino if needed.
Yes. So the MPO or MVP cannot force Palmer to accept a project. Part of the funding that MVP receives right now, we're eligible to receive and program about $10 million a year. So with that, our partners, like if there was going to be a new transit stop in the city of Palmer, they would have to pay their portion of the match for that project to happen. And so if they didn't want that project to happen, they wouldn't agree to the match, and that project wouldn't move forward. So though we may be planning for the infrastructure that would benefit the region, taking that, you know, long range view and, you know, what the population needs are for the infrastructure, we wouldn't force a local municipality to do a project.
So and
was there anything from Ms. Gardino? Did you want to add to that? Because you were trying to get a chance in there previously.
Thank you, through the chair, to Representative McCabe. That's exactly right.
And please, Ms. Gardino, just identify yourself for the record. It's our standard practice.
My apologies. My name is Donna Gardino, and I'm with Gardino Consulting Services, working as staff for MVP. And through the co-chair to Representative McCabe, the purpose of an MPO is transportation planning. So we have to have a comprehensive look at transportation planning, because transportation is a network, and that's why we form a boundary, so that we have a network that we're looking at. And if there's a need that's identified, we identify that need in the Metropolitan Transportation Plan, and that is reviewed by the public and by all the stakeholders. And if someone doesn't want a project in there, then that discussion can happen. But ultimately, if the project is not something that the city of Palmer is going, and that's just our example, to endorse or agree to maintain or pay the non-federal share, then it will not move forward, because the state will not allow a project to move forward without a maintenance and a match agreement. Thank you.
Thanks.
Representative Tilton.
Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Kutcher, for your indulgence here today. My question is, we've been talking about the city of Palmer, which is it's a city. My question is, and my concern is more on the other end of the map here with the Kinnick Fairview area, which doesn't have any organized representation outside of the Mat-Su borough. So the voice for that area would be, I'm asking here, would be the Mat-Su borough, with no other voice where the city of Palmer and the city of Wasilla have their own separate voices.
Through the chair to Representative Tilton, I think I understand your question. So yes, so in that area of the borough, the Mat-Su borough and the RSAs, the road service areas for that region would, you know, represent, you know, that region. And though the borough doesn't have road powers, it is responsible for the infrastructure. The state DOT also, in terms of managing Kinnick Goose Bay Road, and that infrastructure. Our responsibility as an MPO is to make sure if projects are being proposed in our long-range plan within that region, that we're talking with the community councils in that area. We're creating opportunities for residents to come and look at our plans, to have a say, to talk about the impacts of this proposed projects. And then let's just say, I don't have an imaginary project, but there was a project that was in our long range plan that we were proposing, and the community didn't really want it, but they wanted something else. So when we're putting together our Metropolitan Transportation Plan, there'll be a lot of opportunity for the public to comment on projects within their area and or outside, depending on their interest. And we will look at every single comment, have internal conversations about the comments, bring those comments to the technical committee and policy board, and seek guidance from those boards on whether or not a change needs to be made or it needs to move forward. So we will be doing our best to ensure that, you know, our plans represent the public's interest and voice, knowing, you know, sometimes people are impacted by projects, and but we're going to do our best to make sure that we're listening and taking feedback.
And Ms. Olin, I'm just looking back at one of the previous slides, and I see one of the members of your policy committee that guides your work, that the mayor of the Mat-Su Borough sits on that. So I'm hoping that would be one of those sources of elected representation. So thank you for that. Please go ahead.
I think we're on slide 10. So back to establishing our planning area boundary, our metropolitan planning area boundary. So as I mentioned before, part of the federal requirement is that our planning area boundary that we create needs to include all of the urbanized area boundary as that was given to us by the census. And it needs to have a 20-year horizon on it, looking at where do we think the population is going to grow? What is going to become urbanized over the next 20 years? And then that is what our boundary, like our minimum boundary, needs to be. Now, our boundary could be as large as the whole Mat-Su Borough. And when we were putting together our boundary development strategy and having conversations about what our boundary, how big our boundary was going to go, the former mayor of the borough did ask for it to, you know, if that could be possible. And the answer is yes. So it could be the whole Mat-Su Borough. But it was ultimately decided that having a smaller boundary focused really on the fastest growing area in the borough that has the greatest need related to population growth and, you know, connectivity and congestion and safety, that we focus our limited dollars on that fastest growing area and our planning efforts on that fastest growing area. So this is documented in our boundary development strategy that I did send out, and I'll follow up with another email in case you didn't get it. In terms of who approves the boundary once we come up with a draft, that is really the MPO's policy board and the governor. So once we come up with the final draft boundary, and I'll talk about all the steps that went into coming up with our boundary, that was signed off on, approved by our policy board, and then submitted to the governor for approval. Federal Highways and the Federal Transit Authority does not need to approve our boundary, but they need to, as soon as it is approved, we were required to send that to them along with our operating agreement. I'm just looking at my notes here. The boundary development strategy was implemented by a planner at the Mat-Su Borough who was tasked to take the boundary development strategy and then to come up with a proposed minimum boundary for MDP. And I just want to give Garrett Verbeek credit because he did a fantastic job. You know, the borough doesn't, you know, I'll stop there and I'll go to my next slide. So how do we figure out what the metropolitan planning area boundary needs to be? As I mentioned before, we need to figure out where do we think the population is going to grow and how many people do we think we're going to add to our region over the next 20 years. How do we need to keep in mind that development density that is a requirement of the census, that you need 1,000 people per square mile or 400 houses per square mile to meet the density requirement to become urbanized. And then I think Representative Tilden mentioned earlier the hops and the jumps. So the census does allow for a little bit of spacing along roadways to jump a segment to be included in the boundary. So how do we take those three pieces, our projected population, the spatial distribution of where are they going to go outside the existing urbanized area, and how do we ensure that those hops and jumps are included? So next slide. One of the things we had to do first was pick a population forecast to come up with how many people we thought were going to move to the area on that 20-year horizon. And so the Mat-Su Bureau doesn't do that population forecasting of their own, but ICER, Institute for Social and Economic Research, previously did population forecasting. Woods and Poole is a national population forecast research group. They had projections for us. The Alaska Department of Labor also has population projections. And so I think there was maybe 10 different projections that Mat-Su Bureau planners looked at and then chose four of those projections, which are being shown on the screen. And ultimately, after a presentation about all the different projections of how fast and how much do we think the Mat-Su Bureau is going to grow over the next 20 years, the policy board determined to use the Alaska Department of Labor 2019 population forecast because it was kind of, it wasn't the high end. And as data is looking, the Mat-Su Bureau's population is starting to trend down a little bit. So they chose the 2019 forecast that projected that we were going to add 46,000 people to the Mat-Su Bureau over the next 20 years. Next slide. So once we determined that the borough would use this...
Ms. Soley, I'm sorry for the interruption. Just going on the previous slide, Representative Carrick, co-chair Carrick has a question.
Thank you. And through the co-chair, I want to have you, and I apologize if you said this and I missed it, but what this says to me is that even if a potential project is not directly within the current boundaries of an MPO, it is within the scope of an MPO to take a look at projects on its outskirts that would potentially be within an urbanized area when making decisions related to the transportation improvement plans. Is that an accurate statement?
Through co-chair Eichheit to represent, or co-chair Carrick. Certainly, let's just use an example. If an Amazon call center were going to be located in Meadow Lakes, that is going to be a significant traffic generator. And so though it would have been outside our metropolitan planning area boundary, as an MPO, we would be looking at it and maybe considering, what changes either to the planning that we're doing inside our boundary or maybe even a look at modifying our boundary to accommodate that new traffic generator. In terms of looking farther out, the state receives a limited amount of federal funds. And so if larger projects are happening throughout the state or in our region, that would potentially impact funding that would be coming to, our region, because we are, in the MPO boundary, the fastest growing, have a lot of need. It is possible that the policy board may want to comment on a project outside the boundary if it would potentially impact funds available for MVP's projects in the future.
Follow up.
And just as a quick follow up, I saw on slide 10, the second bullet, it says that this is this sort of designation is as defined by the Census Bureau. So I guess, can you, you mentioned, you know, the potential of a development of a larger project in, say, the Meadow Lakes area as an example, but there are boundaries on what you can and can't consider, and are those determined by the metropolitan statistical areas from the census, or is it a little bit broader in scope than that? Would your example, in other words, fall within what's determined by the Census Bureau as a metropolitan statistical area?
Through Co-Chair Eichscheid to Co-Chair Carrick, if I understand your question correctly, the metropolitan statistical area, the tongue twister, for the Mat-Su Bureau is the whole Mat-Su Bureau. So that is designated by the census. So when the requirement for MVP in determining our boundary is that we need to look at the urbanized area designation and then look at population forecasts and where we think population is going to grow and where different traffic generators are and project over the next 20 years what we think is going to become urbanized. And that's our minimum boundary. But based on the interest of policymakers or, like I said, big traffic generators or other projects that developers know about what's going on, the policy board could make a determination to make our boundary larger within that metropolitan statistical area boundary. If they had additional information, they could choose to do that. The other thing I'll share is that it's not an exact science projecting where we think population is going to grow and what we think is going to become urbanized. So there isn't a penalty if we don't quite, from Federal Highways, if we don't quite get it right. We have to follow a process. We have to document our data. We have to communicate with the public about what our proposal is. And then our metropolitan planning area is our best guess. Every 10 years, we need to review our boundary to make sure, did we get it right? Did the population grow in the way we thought it was supposed to? And then make adjustments. But we could make adjustments in between that 10-year period too, but every 10 years it is a requirement that we look at it to make sure the urban area hasn't changed and our boundary is still including, or if it has, that our boundary needs to include all of the urban area and then any modifications that we think the next 20 years are going to provide for population growth.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks. So, Ms. Solian, I have a further question on commenting on projects that are sort of on the boundary or outside of your area. So I want to give you a hypothetical Cooper Landing bypass, which comes from a different pot of money. I mean, we all know that the MPOs have a certain pot of money that is divided up, frankly, right now, or it's going to be between MVP and fast planning. And Cooper Landing comes from a completely different pot of money. Would you feel, as an MVP or the head of a metropolitan planning organization, would you feel it in your purview to comment on a huge project like the Cooper Landing bypass, which is more than 100 miles away from the Mat-Su and from your MPA?
Through Co-Chair Eichscheid to Representative McCabe, I guess I want to add a qualifier that I'm new to the MPO world, and I am learning more and more about the federal transportation dollars that come into the state and how the state manages the STIP and how projects get identified and funded. So with that, it's hard to answer a hypothetical question. I would be looking to my policy board for guidance, but if there were a multi-billion-dollar project in an area that all the funds needed for that project hadn't been identified, knowing that in the future the funds would have to be identified and that might impact MVP's ability to do really important projects again, in the fastest growing area of the state with a lot of issues, the policy board may want to comment on something like that. So in terms of me personally, my job is to talk with the technical committee, talk with the policy board, and really present the policy board's decision on what they would want to comment about or not.
Follow up. Thanks for that. So, you know, my question really goes to the crux of the matter, and it's not necessarily the MVP, but the issue, as I see it, is the MPOs are supposed to work on projects on the borders of their MPAs, their metropolitan planning areas, right? And as far as garnering money or commenting on another big project hundreds of miles away, maybe even 500 miles away, just because you think that they're using funding that is supposed to go to you, would seem to me to be way outside of the purview of a metropolitan planning organization's responsibilities. You know, an MPO has a responsibility to focus on their MPA and their area, like if there's something in Meadow Lakes or Big Lakes. I get that. But focusing on the money that the DOT is spending in another project 500 miles away, to me, is not correct. I don't think it's within the purview of the MPO. And frankly, I will work as hard as I can to prevent that from happening again.
Was that a question, Representative McCabe?
No, that was more of a statement. You don't have to comment, Kim. I appreciate it. You're a platform for me to make an editorialized comment.
And Ms. Olin, did you want to make a comment?
Through the chair. No, thank you.
Wise choice. Please continue.
Okay. I think we're on slide 13. So as I mentioned before, the policy board chose to use the population forecast from the Alaska Department of Labor for 2019 that projected that we will add another 46,000 people to the Mat-Su borough over the next 20 years. So knowing that not all of those people are going to move into the urban area, for the purposes of coming up with our boundary, we reduced that number to 43,000, thinking most of the people are going to move to the greater urban area and the rest will move outside into the surrounding areas. So in thinking about, okay, now we know how many people we think, our best guess is how many people are going to move into the area over the next 20 years. How do we figure out where they're going to live or where they're going to go? And so, fortunately, the Mat-Su borough has some great parcel data, and so we dove into that. And so we decided that some of the decisions that we made were that it was likely that those 43,000 people over the next 20 years would likely move onto smaller, undeveloped parcels, so parcels that are less than 5 acres, some of those people would move onto parcels that were involved in existing platting actions, and then some of those people would move onto larger parcels. So we identified all those parcels and layers, and I'll show maps in a second. What we did in terms of thinking about how we're going to spread the population out over our area, we did exclude some lands from the study. We took out all public ownership lands, so the local, city, state, and federal agencies. We removed all the lands from the study that already had a structure on it, and we limited or took out lands that were agricultural lands, either by designation or production right now, to kind of limit like the area in which people could move. As many of you know, Mat-Su borough also has a lot of wetlands. So we also looked at wetlands and ended up determining within the greater core area, the volume, the acreage of wetlands wasn't to the extent that we need to exclude all wetlands in the study. So wetland lands, lands with wetlands were left in. Next slide.
And Ms. Olin, just a comment, a very interesting presentation, but I see you have a number of slides left, so if you can do the abbreviated version, I'd appreciate that.
Absolutely. Okay, slide 14 is just a map highlighting all the unbuilt parcels under 5 acres, where about 32,000 people could fit there. Next slide highlights all the parcels that are within current platting actions. About, 20,000 residents could squeeze into those. Next slide, 16, highlights all the other privately owned unbuilt parcels that are larger than 5 acres. And through our determination, we could add another 200,000 residents on those parcels. Next slide. As I mentioned before, we needed to look at development density, traffic impact zones, census blocks to see what was already meeting that density development threshold to then project the layout of all those parcels maps above on top of each other. Is the density going to meet that urbanized threshold, and where should our boundary be? So we selected the forecast, we adjusted it to fit just the study area, we brought in the census blocks and the traffic analysis zones, we ran 4 different scenarios looking at sprawl versus people focusing on popular areas and infill, and the assumption we made was that there wouldn't be any changes in public utilities. So if water and sewer were brought into the region and to serve more people, certainly density could get more dense. But right now we have the 1 acre lot minimum for well and septic, and so that was our projection. Next slide. Well, actually, sorry, 17. So that black outline that you see was our first pass at about a metropolitan planning area boundary. Slide 18. I'll just jump over this. It just highlights the math of where we're going to fit the 43,000 residents, with current construction, existing parcels. We feel like with those layers, we had a pretty good guess. Slide 19. So once we had the draft boundary, we did present that to the Technical Committee and Policy Board. We hosted a meeting with subject matter experts, realtors, development folks, investors, and talked them through our process and asked them to share, do you know about any developments that are happening in the area that would impact this boundary? Are there, large subdivisions or a large, commercial development that we should know about? Next slide. We received about 72 comments during our comment period. So we shared the draft with the Technical Committee and Policy Board. We met with subject matter experts. We collected comments from them. We highlighted areas around the boundary based on comments that we received. We hosted a public meeting. We received additional comments from the public and documented them all in the boundary development report. So next map, please. So the numbers around the map are corresponding to some of the questions that are the comments that we received on the slide before. And so just to highlight some of those questions that we looked at, like some of the comments were like question 9 was about should we excluded, there was a jog in the boundary, but then Reddington Elementary School was right on the boundary. And a member of the public said, you might want to include Reddington because we're having some traffic impact and drop-off issues with school related to COVID, and we might want to plan differently and have that included. And so we, proposed making that change. We also decided to follow natural feature boundaries. So we followed the Matanuska River outline as a geographic boundary. We also got comments and questions about GPRA, Palmer Hayflats Refuge, and the Moose Range to expand our boundary a little bit to those park systems because they are significant traffic generators and increasing over time. And a lot of the neighborhoods that surround the parks weren't designed to accommodate that level of traffic. But including them in the boundary gives us the ability to plan for that infrastructure to support access to those regions. Other questions were like, some of the boundary, it was a little bit of GIS cleanup and we were splitting roads in half or, had a line through a neighborhood and needed to make a bump out. Next slide. So this map highlights the final boundary that was approved by the policy board in September 2023. You can see that it includes the entire urbanized or urban area plus the area we think will become urbanized over the next 20 years. It's 120 square miles. About 73,000 people live within our metropolitan planning area boundary. So of the 120,000-ish people that live in the borough, the majority of people do are, you know, within our boundary. And like I said before, it was approved by the policy board and by the governor in 2023 when we signed our operating agreement. Next slide. I'm going to transition now to some of the, unless there are questions, to the STIP development challenges, because that was the third piece of information that you all kind of asked us to talk about. Next slide, please. So I'm on slide 25. So some of the challenges with the STIP development, so we're a new MPO, we're a new organization, so we're still building our organizational processes and our organization itself. So many of our technical committee and our policy board members have not served on an MPO before, and so we're all learning. For us, communication and involvement with the STIP development process has been a little bit inconsistent. And having just formed, our understanding of who we are and why we exist, which is to support local control of federal funds within our planning area boundary to make sure that those federal funds that are coming through the state DOT into our area, that we've work together on how that money is going to be spent. So some of the inconsistent communication has been challenging for us to know, aren't there processes already developed and why is this confusion happening? Next slide.
Oh, Ms. Olin. Ms. Olin.
Oh, yep.
I'm just, I had a question on the slide you just wrapped up with. Can you just flesh out, you said on the last two bullets, it says, you know, just define that inconsistent term a little more. You know, you went a little fast on that. So I had a, just if you can define that or flesh that out just a little bit, and then we'll go to Representative McCabe after you answer that question.
Absolutely. To the co-chair, Aishad. In my experience in the past, there has been a STIP team, and so I'm wearing a different hat at the moment. In my past life, when I worked for the Mat-Su Borough, and when a STIP was being developed, you know, planners, you know, connected to the central region, we'd have a special meeting, we'd look at all the projects, we'd understand the funding and have an opportunity to communicate. For us as a new MPO, though we're eligible to receive our allocation of federal funds starting on October 1st, 2024, understanding exactly what our allocation is and the different pots of money, the surface transportation block grant funds, the TAP funds, transportation, I'm going to space on my acronyms right now, the congestion management funds, CRP funds, we're supposed to get a certain amount of funding, the transit funds, and that is supposed to be documented. And so for us, the funds that are coming to us for fiscal year 24 and 25 and 6 and 27, every time when the STIP was developed and then the amendments 1 and amendment 2 were developed, those pots of money have changed or the numbers are different. And or the projects that the policy board approved in our program of projects, though we don't have an MTP or a TIP, we're eligible for the funds. And so Federal Highways suggested that we create a program of projects that is approved by the policy board. So we looked at our annual allocations, decided which projects that were moving forward in the region in our planning area, and the policy board determined how much money they wanted to go to different projects that were already happening. So all our projects are listed in the STIP. So we're trying to track, okay, the STIP has come out and these are the allocations prior to the STIP being released that we were told we were going to get. They look different in the STIP. We commented on that. Then they look different in the amendment, and we commented on that. And now the second amendment, things are still a little bit different, and we still have questions. So that's what I mean about confusion in terms of what are our allocations, and is what the policy board approved for how our allocations will be spent being followed? And we just have questions because it's changed from the original and Amendment 1 and Amendment 2. I hope that answers your question.
Yes, it was very detailed. And then, so does that make the MPO's work more difficult, these inconsistencies?
To Co-Chair Eichheit, for me it has, because every time a STIP, I'm having to learn, like, the STIP document was released and things are different than what we thought they would were going to be, and I had to learn how to read the fiscal constraint tables and the project. I mean, they're 1,000-page documents, and we have to go line by line and figure out what's changed. We didn't receive a summary of changes, or didn't receive information. Like, we didn't have a pre-meeting prior to the STIP release, or either one or two STIP amendment release. And so I have to, in addition to the other work that we're doing, you know, learn the STIP every time it's come out because it's changed, and we didn't get a summary of comments to be able to focus on that. And we didn't have a pre-meeting so that we could have, for us, we could have addressed some of the inconsistencies or the errors prior to the STIP or amendments being released had we been invited to have a conversation about the errors we saw.
Thank you. Representative McCabe.
Thanks, and through the chair, Ms. Soline. So at the end of the day, the Metropolitan Planning Organization is a planning organization. You don't schedule contractors. You don't let contracts. You don't approve contracts. You're just a planning organization. And I think that you are discovering, I mean, the legislature is a planning organization, and we can only plan for the amount of money that may come in revenue-wise. So the DOT is the people that let the contracts. They're the ones that plan the contracts. They're the ones that spend the money, actually. So if you're struggling with the money, I wonder if it's not because you actually are working alongside the DOT. They don't work for you. Is that sort of encapsulate? I mean, that's kind of my thoughts. And I know it's a struggle, and I get that, and things are going to change. I've been in the military. I've been in this role, and money changes in this role daily. And I think that you're struggling with the same idea, and I'm sorry it's like that, but it frustrates me that there's an expectation from the MPOs that once they put in a amount of money, that that's absolutely what they're going to get, and that is not the way it's, I don't think, was ever envisioned. Is that, I mean, am I way off base here or what?
Through Co-Chair Eichheit to Representative McCabe, well, for MVP, we're in a little bit of a different situation because we don't have a Metropolitan Transportation Plan, and we don't have a Transportation Improvement Program, which is that fiscally constrained funding plan. So once we have one of those, what we program in the TIP needs to be what's moving forward. Like, that can't change. So that does need to be clear. So you are correct. We are not issuing the contracts and managing the contracts, but we are the steward of the funding that comes into our area and having that be documented correctly based on the projects that the policy board has approved, but also all the projects that are in our boundary. So we're keeping, in the future, MVP will be keeping a complex log of all the funding and all the projects that are coming into our area. And every time there's a funding change, because I recognize costs go up or priorities change, we'll need to document that in our TIP so that it is accurate. But for us right now, because we don't have an MTP or TIP, you know, our projects that our policy board approved are in the STIP. But we do receive our own allocation of funding that the policy board is programming. So, yes, things change, but it just needs to be documented and communication needs to be consistent.
Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Through the chair, Representative McCabe, we are the appropriators. Keep that in mind.
But you can't appropriate what you don't have. I do have
a question. So if I'm not mistaken, I heard you say that you have been involved with the STIP when you worked for the Mat-Su Borough. Am I correct?
Through the chair to Representative Stutes, yes.
So, and now working with the MPO on this current STIP, did you find it more difficult working with people that had no experience working on the STIP?
Through Co-Chair Eichheid to Representative Stutes, I think for me what was challenging is that I work very closely with the planning team from Central Region, and specifically there's a planner that works directly with MVP's planner that works for DOT and the engineering team at the Mat-Su office. And so we have very close working relationships. I think what had been challenging for me is I didn't know who the STIP team was, and my planners weren't always, that I work with at the state, weren't always getting the information to share with me, and I didn't know who to contact. Which seems different than when I worked for the borough, when we would have a sit down when I worked in the planning department with DOT planners to talk about the STIP and all the projects that are moving forward within the Mat-Su borough. We'd have a conversation about every single one of them before the STIP was released. And so that just seemed different.
Through the chair,
follow
if
up.
I might. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. The reason I asked that question was when we had the commissioner of DOT here last year, he did say that the people working on the STIP, there was no prior experience in working with the STIP. So then I have one more question that I might ask, and this is based on my friend Representative McCabe's comment a little earlier, if I might, Mr. Co-Chair.
Yes.
And I'm not sure of this, so this is a question. When the different MPOs are allocated their dollars, is there a fund of money and then the allocation goes out to the different MPOs through that single fund? Based on the information that has been provided, of course.
Through Co-Chair Eichheid to Representative Stutes, I might phone a friend on this one and ask Donna or Gardino to come online. I'll answer some of it. Is that FAST Planning and MVP are small MPOs, and so and AMATS is a large MPO, and part of the Surface Transportation Block Grant funding that comes into the state, a portion needs to go to the urbanized areas, and that is portioned by formula. In addition to that, the TAP funds and the CRP funds and CMAC funds, which we don't get, also are outlined in terms of a formula on what would come to the MPO based on our size. So I guess I'm lost in the question, but our funds come to us based on a formula, and I would like to invite Donna if you would like to add to that to help clarify where the funding is coming from. Can you hear me, Donna?
Through the chair, if I may, Donna Gardino with Gardino Consulting Services to Representative Stutes. Kim is correct. We will be getting an allocation of funding, and typically we are sent a memo that tells us how much of each funding category we should be allocating in the TIP for all of the projects. The funding never really directly comes to us. We just get the numbers so that we can program projects up to that amount of funding. And so typically, we know what that number is, and what Kim has said here already is that that number keeps changing with every STIP or STIP amendment when it's really by formula. And so it's kind of been inconsistent in that we don't expect it to really vary. And that's one of the things we've asked for, is to have that that formula funding presented to us in a memo so that we can be assured when we're programming a four-year TIP that it's fiscally constrained. And so that's kind of what we're working for now. And then just to be told you know, if there's changes on any of our projects that we know ahead of time so that we can make adjustments in the TIF, because it is a fiscally constrained document.
Let me tell you where I'm going with that, and I'm not sure that this is a valid thought or a valid line of thinking, is I heard my friend from Big Lake suggest that one MPO shouldn't be looking at issues outside their area. But if there are, which has happened, there are things that are put in the STIP that cost money that have been declared ineligible by the federal government for the STIP. And then they go in there again. Are those funds that are allocated to this ineligible project coming out of the pot of money that every other MPO is entitled to? And if it is, then I would say yes. MPOs are certainly should be looking at all the other things. If it doesn't affect it, then I might lean towards the direction you're going. I'm just not sure which is which. Thank you, Mr. Chair, now that I've totally confused everybody, including myself somewhat.
Thank you, Representative Tilton.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair Eisheib. And through the chair, I'm going to talk about money, but not about the STIP and TIP and all of those things. You said you initially were able to set up or through a grant through the state of Alaska for $1 million. What is the funding source for continued funding for your organization? I guess what I'm looking at is if we have dollars coming to the state from the federal government for specific projects, how many different organizations are taking dollars off of that? Those dollars coming in to fund all these organizations that are making sure that we all get the right amount of dollars.
Through Co-Chair Eisheib to Representative Tilden, there are three MPOs in the state, and by formula, we are out. Each of the three MPOs are allocated planning funding to manage the operations of our office and to do the planning projects. And then there is a portion of funds granted that we program for our region. So like for us, for MVP, we're getting about $400,000 a year to do the planning work and to manage the organization and the boards and the committees and the public involvement and all the plans. And then about $10 million a year in project funding that the state manages, but that we track. So to your point about other organizations getting money, I'm only aware that of, you know, four MPOs, there's just three of us.
Okay, thanks.
Oh, if I may, all of our member organizations, the two cities, the two tribes, and the borough, and the DOT, all are responsible for contributing to projects. Like if Mat-Su Borough says we want a new, for instance, the bike path along Wasilla Fishhook, they're paying the match. So even if the MPO is allocating a portion of our funding to support that project, the borough is responsible for the 9% match, as would any of the cities or the tribes be if they were responsible for a project within their service area. Thank you.
Follow-up, please. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I guess what I was looking at more is the administrative funding, and it sounds like you're getting if I'm hearing you right, you're getting a $400,000 amount that's to help with, you know, pay for all of those administrative things. So you're not taking, I mean, essentially those dollars could have gone into a project if there wasn't an organization that needed to have the funding to do all this planning. I guess that's what I'm looking at is how much of all of the dollar that are coming in that we're going through the planning organization, we might be going through the Mat-Su Borough, we might be going through even the state of Alaska. How much of those funds that are going for, you know, coming in for projects are, you know, being used for administrative costs? And I guess that's just kind of what I'm looking at, but you may not have an answer to that.
Any comment, Ms. Solin?
Well, through the co-chair, Aishat, to Representative Tilden, yeah, I don't have the formulas in front of me about how much funds that is required by federal law to go to the urban areas versus how the federal funds can be used throughout the rest of the state and other areas. But that is set in formula. But I don't have the actual numbers in front of me, so I can't be specific in terms of a dollar amount.
Representative McCabe?
Thanks. So I noticed a sort of a juxtaposition or a change in terms when Ms. Giardino was talking. So we're dealing with municipal or metropolitan, rather, planning organizations, and you use the term programming almost exclusively in your last response. You said programming three or four times, and I'm wondering if that's not where the problem is. Planning seems to be more of a cooperative side-by-side partnership with the DOT, and programming seems to me like the MPO or MVP thinks that it's their job to do more than that, like the DOT actually works for them. And I think from what I've seen on this committee in last year, there was an issue where it seemed like the MPOs thought that they were in charge. And I'm wondering if that's where the sort of the headbutting comes in lately. So maybe Ms. Giardino could comment on the difference between planning and programming. And maybe she just, in her job, she uses programming all the time, and it was inadvertent.
Through co-chair to Representative McCabe, the MPO is responsible for all the planning within the metropolitan planning area. In that same vein, we are also responsible for programming the transportation improvement program. So whatever allocation, let's say we have $10 million in federal fiscal year 25, we have to program that funding in the TIP. And if programming and if costs come in slightly lower or higher, it's not going to be a big deal. But if there's major changes to a project cost or schedule, we have to reflect those through an amendment to the TIP, just like the state would do an amendment to the STIP. And so, and the other piece is, if we don't program all of our funds in 1 year, we could lose that money. And so we would want to know if, let's say, a schedule got pushed out, then we need to illustrate in our TIP that that project is moving from federal fiscal year 25 to 26, and we would have to try to find another project that we could actually fund in federal fiscal year 25 so that we wouldn't lose that money, or alternatively ask the state, since they're managing the projects, if they would allow us to carry that funding over. But we have to have that conversation before it becomes a crisis so that we don't lose the funding.
Thanks for that. Seems like the MPO has the same problem with the state as the state has with federal highways. So,
okay. Please continue. I see no other questions at this time.
I think we discussed slide 26. Slide 27, I'm just on to questions. And that's the last of my presentation, other than contact information on the last slide.
Okay.
So,
well, thank you, Ms. Solin, and your staff people are joining you. It's time for general questions. Co-chair Carrick has a question.
Well, thank you, Co-chair Aishat. I actually just have a comment. So DOT is in charge of consultation with MPOs. And can I just get that clarified first, I guess, with Ms. Solian?
And, to Co-Chair Carrick, I guess I need more information so about the question. So the state DOT, I'll try, and then if I get it wrong or you need more information, let me know. State DOT is responsible for producing the STIP. And MVP's in a different spot right now because we don't have a TIP that would be incorporated by reference into the STIP. So all of our projects are in the STIP. But DOT is responsible for letting us know what our allocations are for the year so that we can program our funds and run them through our boards and through the public to know which projects we want to support. All of that happens in our MTP and then in our TIP. But again, we are a little bit different. But yes, if the state is responsible for the STIP and the federal funding that is coming into the state, they are then responsible to communicate with us in a timely manner so that we know what our annual allocations are.
Thank you for that. That does answer the question. And I guess through the chair, my comment is that the criticism that all MPOs have had over the course of our most recent STIP process is a lack of consistent consultation and communication about the projects that are in the TIP and potential changes. And I see that as DOT is the common denominator between all of our statewide MPOs. DOT is also the common denominator when it comes to working with federal highways and responding to feedback and providing clear feedback about how we're going to have amendments to our STIP. So in other words, DOT is the common denominator, and I suppose that's just a comment to put out there regarding our most recent STIP projects.
Representative McCabe.
Thanks, and through the chair, Ms. Soline, is there ever a time, and I know that you're new, so, but maybe you can tell me your understanding, is there ever a time when you would go around the DOT and go directly to federal highways for requests for projects or requests for money, or are you obligated to involve the DOT before you go to federal highways?
Through the chair to Representative McCabe, I'm not really sure how to answer the question, and I don't know. Federal Highways is a partner like DOT is a partner, and I don't know how to answer the question. I have not had I have not gone around DOT to ask Federal Highways questions, and so I don't have a frame of reference to answer that question. And I don't know if Donna has any experience in her former life as a director to answer that, but I don't know how to answer the question.
Yeah, and through the chair, follow-up. Thanks for that. Yeah, that's good enough. I just am curious what the responsibilities of a MPO, the head of an MPO is, as far as when you have to go to federal highways, do you take the DOT with you, or do you think you can go by yourself, and do you think you can comment or contact the federal highways? And I think what you said is probably enough. Thanks.
Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I appreciate this, and I appreciate this opportunity because I'm learning a lot. So my question is, on these projects that are determined to be the projects that are going to go forward, are they projects that always the MPOs are involved in, or are there occasions where DOT unilaterally decides this is a project that we're going to move forward with to the objection of the MPO? Has that ever been a situation?
That's a good question.
Through the chair to Representative Stutes. So just to clarify, the purpose of the MPO is to plan, to do long-range planning about all the projects that could and should happen within our boundary. And so, and all those projects need to be listed in our Metropolitan Transportation Plan and then in our TIP, which is the Fiscally Constrained Funding Plan that does short-term, mid-term, and long-term projects. So with that, if a new project comes up as a priority, or let's say the state, but it isn't in our MTP and it isn't in our TIP, the MPO has the responsibility to bring that project forward and to run it through our process, because we would need to update our Metropolitan Transportation Plan and we would need to update the TIP for that to be eligible for funding within our planning area boundary. The policy board has the opportunity, of which the state serves on for MVP and has a vote, the policy board has an opportunity to say that actually that project that's just come forward isn't a priority for us and we're not going to approve the amendment and addition of it into our MTP and TIP. So that is kind of foundational to why the MPOs exist. They are supposed to collaboratively come together as a policy board and decide what the priority projects are. The city of Palmer or the borough has a project that becomes a priority and they want to bring it forward. We have a process that we go through. We also talk with the public about it, but ultimately if the policy board decides that's not a priority, they get to do that.
Follow up.
I really appreciate this opportunity. So have there been instances where, say, the DOT has gone around the MPO to their objection and moved forward with a project maybe that has been turned down by the MPOs or the planning board and whomever else?
Through the chair to Representative Stutes, like that, I would defer to Jackson Fox. Don is no longer on the call with us. He's the director for Fast Planning, the MPO in Fairbanks. He has a lot more time and experience with his MPO. He could probably answer that better than I. I don't have a specific project for MVP that I can reference. Oh, Donna is here. But anyway, if you would like to hear from Jackson, I'm sure he could better answer that question than I.
Yes, I believe Jackson Fox is on the line, according to my screen. Mr. Fox, if you're on the line, if you can unmute and identify yourself for the record and address Representative Stutes' question.
Yes, for the record, this is Jackson Fox, the Executive Director of Fast Planning. So through the chair to Representative Stutes, that exact situation that you described has occurred up in Fairbanks with two bridge replacement projects, one of which was on the Steese Highway, Milepost 5, and another one that was on the Richardson Highway to the south of us, Milepost 346. So these are projects that were never planned or coordinated with our MPO. So as DOT was trying to advance them into design and get them to construction, they ran into the roadblock of those two particular projects not being in our local transportation plans, as Kim was stating, our MTP and our TIP. And so for those projects to advance forward to construction, they would need to be amended into our plans. One of those bridge projects, Federal Highways did overturn a previous decision and allowed the Richardson Highway bridge replacement project to move forward because our new boundary is not yet approved by the governor. And that project is outside our old boundary, but within our new boundary. But since it's not yet approved by the governor, that one's allowed to move forward. The other project, however, on the Steese Highway, Milepost 5, provided it's not in our plans, it cannot advance forward until we include it. Our board specifically considered that. They don't remember the exact date, but it was about a year or so ago. And they did decide to not include that in our plans. And it wasn't entirely because they didn't agree with the project. It was because we didn't have enough time to amend our plans before the conformity freeze was going to hit us up here in Fairbanks. So we didn't have enough time to complete our work to include it. But that project could have been included if it was coordinated with us from the start of the project. Last thing I'll say is that unfortunately the Anchorage AMAS director is not on the call here today, but there are four examples of projects in the Anchorage area that were in that same situation. So it has happened in Fairbanks and it has happened in Anchorage.
If I might, Mr. Chair.
Yes, one more follow-up.
This is my last, and it's more of a comment. It's nice to know at least the local municipalities have some say, which takes me back to Representative Tilton when she said, well, what if the local people don't want it? Then obviously you have some opportunity to say it's not going to happen. So this is really an interesting process. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the indulgence.
Yes, we are winding up on time, so I'm going to recognize Representative McCabe for one. And then I have a question, and then we'll wrap up. Obviously, we are not done, so we'll come back to this. My apologies for having a robust conversation. Representative McCabe.
Thanks, and through the chair, Mr. Fox. So these two bridges that you're talking about, have they ever previously been in a STIP or previously had any comments gone through your process, if you will, with public comments? Or are you just objecting to this STIP? Or I'm a little unclear on which bridges are which up there because I don't live there.
Yeah, so these two particular bridges have never been on our transportation. I apologize. For the record, this is Jackson Fox, Executive Director of Fast Planning, and through the chair to Representative McCabe. These two particular bridge projects have never come up in our transportation planning process because one of the bridges is in good condition and the other one is in good to fair condition. But we would be paying attention to bridges that were in poor condition, that, say, had a structural deficiency or were functionally obsolete, et cetera. So they've not previously been identified in our planning documents as a need for replacement in our area. We have other bridges that are needs, but not these particular ones. But the need seemed to arose at DOT for these bridge replacements to try to get these done in support of the ore haul up here. So it was news to us. And of course, these bridge replacements with the public locally, we received a very large volume of comments on them, through the STIP, but as well as directly to Fast Planning as we discussed them at our meeting. So because of the controversial nature of that. But again, one is moving forward, and the other one right now is simply paused until our conformity freeze can get lifted, and we will likely include that other bridge replacement project in our plans. And that will, again, be subject to public comment.
Fair enough. Thanks.
And Mr. Fox, this is a final question, so a brief answer, please, because we're almost out of time. I remember this being discussed previously, but I don't have it, in the center of my mind. But the new fast boundary map, fast area, was submitted to the governor's office for review and hopefully approval. When? When was that submitted to the governor's office?
Again, for the record, this is Jackson Fox, Executive Director of Fast Planning. Our boundary development process was completed by November of 2023, and the boundary was submitted to the Commissioner's Office to advance to the Governor for approval in December of 2023. So it has been a year and about 5 months.
Thank you, Mr. Fox. That's interesting information. I want to apologize to DOT. We didn't get to you. I have to work with my co-chair, but I would like to continue this conversation. And it was very robust, and really appreciate the committee. Some really good questions. So let's keep talking. That concludes today. Oh, and I would like to thank as well Ms. Solian, Mr. Winstaffer, and Ms. Gardino for being here. We did lose a couple of our people from FAST, Mayor Hopkins and Mr. Crass. They couldn't stick on. So I hope we can continue this conversation. So that concludes today's House Transportation Committee meeting. Thank you to everybody for taking the time to appear before us. The Tuesday, April 8th House Transportation Committee meeting has been canceled. Our next House Transportation Committee meeting will be Thursday. Oh, excuse me, correction. It's not canceled.
Mr. Co-Chair.
I'd like my co-chair, Carrick, to please correct me.
So next Tuesday's House Transportation Committee meeting is not scheduled, but in lieu of next Tuesday's House Transportation Committee meeting, Co-Chair Eichheid and myself would like to invite all committee members, strongly encourage all committee members to please join us at the Auk Bay Ferry Terminal from 12:30 to 3 o'clock. for a tour of the Columbia Ferries engine room. And we do have transportation to and from.
Because we're the transportation committee.
So thank you, Co-Chair Carrick, for that correction. I was just actually prompting that because I knew a different voice would be paid more attention to. So thank you for that. And then next Thursday, April 10th at 1 o'clock, we will consider any amendments to House Bill 26, Representative Mina's statewide public and community transit plan, and hear a bill introduction for H.J.R. 14, Representative McCabe's Port McKenzie and Northern Rail Extensions, as well as a presentation from the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities on the department's role in emergency response in Alaska. Seeing no other questions, this meeting of the House Transportation Committee is adjourned at 3:02 p.m.